presenter is Dr. Carrie Nash. Dr. Nash is Associate Professor of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington. Her research is focused on the use of genetic approaches to characterize fitness changes in Pacific salmon populations and exploring conservation measures that may preserve this fitness. Carrie's presentation is entitled Key Information Needs to Understand Balance Between Risk and Benefit of Hatchery Supplementation of Chinook Salmon. Carrie.
Well, thank you, everyone. I'd like to thank everyone, especially for inviting me here. It's actually a great privilege to serve with this panel. So today what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about research areas around this. And before I start, I was asked very specifically to talk about risks of hatcheries, and I could sit here and actually give you a very big shopping list of everything that's very negative or positive about hatcheries. Instead, what I'd like to do is actually direct you to some of these very great reviews that have been written recently, because there's a lot of very good minds dealing with this. I'd also like to especially acknowledge the work of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, which is captured in this last reference. I'm going to shine this light on everyone's heads instead of these slides. This very last reference, which encapsulates a lot of the work that the Hatchery Scientific Review Group in the Pacific Northwest is doing. We published a review on the impacts of conservation and fishery hatcheries back in 2008. And we basically went through the major risks, which was competition, ecological interactions, fisheries, genetic risks, and disease risks. And it was quite apparent that the literature is replete with examples of negative effects of hatchery fish. And one of the points that we made in this hatchery review was essentially that it was very difficult for us to separate the effects of management actions on hatchery fish and their effect on wild fish, or simply that hatchery fish had a negative effect on wild fish. So essentially what we said is that a key need in this area is the development of a strong understanding to the degree to which specific management actions actually cause changes in hatchery fish. We're not the first people to actually raise this point. This point was made in 1995. We raised this point. It's repeatedly raised throughout a lot of the reviews. And so what I want to do in this talk is actually advocate a strong research-based approach to understanding what risks hatchery practices have and whether we can do anything about that. And so essentially what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the key discussion that's actually happening primarily in the Pacific Northwest associated with minimizing risks. I'm going to discuss some examples of outstanding issues and then end with considerations for planning for a new program. Now, anyone who follows the literature on the discussion on the hatchery reform process that's actually happened in the Pacific Northwest is that the Hatchery Scientific Review Group has basically come up with two models for managing hatcheries, right? Essentially, the rationale is that you either integrate the hatchery or you segregate the hatchery fish from the wild fish. The rationale behind the integrated hatchery was actually based on a whole bunch of genetics modeling. So essentially what they showed is that if there's sufficient gene flow between the hatchery and the wild fish, you won't have evolution you'll have minimal evolution of the hatchery fish from the wild fish, and therefore minimal impact of hatchery on wild fish. The basic premise is that you actually get your gene flow from the wild to the hatchery exceeds that from the hatchery to the wild. So that's one of the basic premises of this. The alternative is the segregated hatchery, right, which is pretty much the model that's being followed in the Chinook hatcheries up here, which is essentially you direct fishing effort away from wild populations and you allow little to no spawning in the wild at all. So what I thought I would do is I would just take us through a little bit of the research that's been done since these recommendations came out, just to show you where the state of knowledge is, Okay, regarding these two discussions. And I'm going to start with the segregated hatchery example. Now, it's really important to point out that in the Pacific Northwest, most of our examples are actually coming from the integrated approach, because the Hatchery Scientific Review Group basically concluded it was pretty difficult to segregate hatchery and wild fish in places like the Columbia River or the Puget Sound, where most of this is happening. So we've actually done research on segregated hatcheries. In our group, we've looked at the practice of actually releasing steelhead populations. And essentially the way that they achieve segregation in these populations is by return timing. So what's happening is that they're taking in an out-of-basin stock primarily, which returns at a separate time from the wild population. And so essentially what we did is that we actually started this study, not me because I wasn't around at the time, but this study was started way back in the founder years in 1998 to and all the fish coming back to the hatchery and to the wild weir were actually collected at the same time. Now, it's really important to notice that in these founder years, we actually basically had fairly clear segregation by timing within this population. But over time, what we've done is that we've studied this over many years. Over time, what we're actually seeing is that the proportion of wild fish returning to the hatchery is actually declining. So we're using our genetic approaches. We're assigning fish to wild or hatchery origin, and we're finding that the proportion of the wild fish is actually declining, both in the smolt release and in the wild returns, right? Notice that the wild returns, you have more wild fish. And what we've attributed this to is that we've attributed to a shift in the hatchery population's return timing. So essentially, here's our baseline data from those founder years, and then this is the spread of the hatchery population over time. What we're seeing is this increase of fish, which we've called unassigned, we've conservatively called unassigned, which we've, with a whole bunch of simulations, we've realized are probably hybrids between hatchery and wild fish. So essentially what's happened by this, by trying to introduce a different life history strategy within these streams, the hatchery fish have actually shifted their return timing and probably interbreeding with the wild fish. Now, so I don't mean this to be a very negative story about segregation hatcheries. Just want to point out that using life history timing may not necessarily be the way to go. As far as I know, there's almost no research on trying to separate hatcheries spatially. But there are still a number of people in the Pacific Northwest who strongly advocate this approach to hatchery management in the area. So this is a somewhat famous paper. It was published in 2007, and this one addresses particularly the role of integrated hatcheries and whether they can produce fish that are as fit as the wild wild population. So essentially what happened here is that they had two generations. So this is one generation in the hatchery. They produced captive fish, and then they were able to produce a whole bunch of crosses where essentially you've got a captive fish cross a wild fish and then wild cross wild, and they were able to do these direct comparisons between these two different types. What's really interesting is that you'll see is that these individuals here have half the wild genes, right? So in what they're doing is they're inadvertently testing the role of gene flow in trying to maintain fitness. In their first generation, they found that hatchery fish returned at pretty much, they had pretty similar fitness ranges as the wild fish. But in the second generation, they found that these hybrid fish had less fitness than the wild fish. So this was somewhat controversial because what it was is it was demonstrating just that one generation of rearing can actually decline the fitness in hatchery fish. So what's happened is that a number of studies have actually been published since, actually looking at integrated hatcheries. And coming from that very same group, what they've done is they've shown that they found not only did you get reduced fitness in hatchery descendants beyond that that second generation, but you also found that spawning in the wild reduced the wild population size. So it seemed to have a wild an effect on population size. And they assumed that there was about 40% contributions from the wild population. They also found evidence for domestication selection being the reason for this decline in fitness. In contrast, you've actually got work that's been done on the Hood Canal in Puget Sound. And essentially, this group found no changes in genetic diversity or effective population size in adult to par production. And interestingly, there's actually been a challenge to the technique used by this group, where essentially they challenged the mathematical basis of the estimates that are used in these studies. In Chum Salmon, again, a group working in Hood Canal, the same group working on Steelhead, and what they found in a spawning channel is that hatchery and wild had similar fitness after three generations of culture. Another interesting group of studies are basically done by in Oregon again and then in Canada. So let me speak to this one first. In Canada, what they did is that they actually set up a very clear breeding design. And they found that rearing environment, this is the natural environment versus a traditional environment, so normal concrete raceways, actually affected fitness. And they found no genetic basis for the differences in fitness, right? So they could do this very clearly because they set up these crosses in a very clear quantitative genetic framework. On the other hand, the group in Oregon, what they're doing is that they're actually looking at coho fish hatcheries, and they found that hatchery fish had lower reproductive success. They examined fry releases versus smolt releases and found that they had similar success, but had lower reproductive success than the wild populations. And what they believed it was due to was the absence of sexual selection in the hatchery. So these fish aren't actually getting to choose who they mate with, and they believe that this is the basis for the decline in fitness. In Chinook, okay, so this is more relevant to the symposium, this group working on the clear heirloom have actually done a number of comparative studies, and they found no fitness differences after one generation of hatchery rearing. So this was work done in a spawning channel. In contrast, in a very well-established hatchery program, which is going since 1982, where the fish are actually integrated with the wild population, they found that hatchery fish had lower fitness than wild fish. Right? What they attributed this to, and probably what's interesting, is that they attributed this to the fact that the hatchery fish were coming back younger. Right, so they were competing with older, bigger fish and therefore were less successful, but also that they were not coming back to reasonable habitats, spawning habitats, compared to the wild populations. And they just recently published, like literally still hot off the presses, study on Chinook where essentially what they did is that they looked at hatchery fish over a single generation. They provided a demographic boost, and then they studied the reproductive success of those hatchery fish spawning in the wild, and found out that they in fact contributed, there was no significant fitness difference between those populations. So this is work done out of Sean Nerum's lab, and you heard from Sean yesterday. So what's the take-home message from this? It's actually, what you can see is in classic scientific form, you see a little bit of contradiction that's going on in these studies, right? And I think that one of the really important things, and this is what I wanted to advocate for, is the importance of being able to track these changes over very long time frames within a research framework, as has been done here, right? So what these folks are doing is that they are actually catching all the fish, measuring the reproductive success using genetic approaches, and they're able to track changes in their populations over time, right? So essentially this research-based approach is informing a lot of the decisions they make. Now, what I want to do was talk about some of the outstanding issues that's going on here, because essentially what you're doing is that you're seeing a bunch of studies focused on examining relative reproductive success. There's a number of other issues that we're not really paying attention to yet, which I think that we do need to. First is, what are we using as measures of success in supplementation? So each of these studies are actually focused on relative reproductive success, and they're saying the hatchery fish should be as fit as the wild fish, right? Whereas in fact, maybe the hatchery fish should not be as fit as the wild fish because they've spent a generation in the hatchery. A whole bunch of individuals have got to reproduce that wouldn't be able to reproduce. So maybe a decline in fitness in one generation is actually what we would expect if we were doing our jobs properly. So we have to think very carefully about what we're thinking about when we measure success in supplementation programs. There's an issue about optimal levels of gene flow. So the Hatchery Scientific Review Group have modeled a whole bunch of scenarios to say how much gene flow should you have between the hatchery and the wild fish. And it's been shown in models, but we need empirical verification of that. One thing we need to think about is the effects of broodstock collection on the wild fish, and this is within the integrated system. And then very specifically, we've known that these populations, the models are actually showing us that over the long term, integrated programs may still compromise wild populations. So therefore, should we be trying to do research to find out how long we can carry on doing integrated programs? And then there are the usual disease type of questions. Within segregated situations, what we should be thinking about is, are there design strategies that prevent negative interactions? So the spatial segregation that's favored in Alaska, how effective are these in actually preventing interactions between wild and hatchery fishes? And if the systems fail, how much gene flow is actually acceptable between these two components if the hatchery fish actually do get to mate with a wild fish? Again, we have to think about the effects of broodstock collection and mixed stock fisheries, and again, we have to think about disease issues. But one thing I wanted to address in particular, or highlight in particular, is the importance of release sizes. And this has come up, but I want to talk about it first from a genetic perspective, and then secondly, from an ecological perspective. One thing that we really have to think about is that the release size, might actually compromise the genetic diversity of a population. This is an effect that's been recorded for a very long time. It's known as the Riemann-Lycra effect. Essentially what happens is that you take your wild population, you take a small fraction of that population, you amplify it up in the hatchery, you release them. What you're doing is that you're actually taking a minority of this population and you're swamping the majority of the population with this reduced genetic diversity. So it actually, advanced scenarios are actually showing us that the opportunities for increasing genetic diversity in a population are actually quite limited. So this rather complicated slide is assuming that I've got an effective population size of 100, right? This is just a pretentious way that geneticists actually measure genetic diversity or population size. The key thing is that most populations actually have effective sizes much lower than census sizes, right? On this axis, you've got the effective population size of the wild population, and this is the proportion of hatchery fish in the wild population. In white, what I'm showing here is that there are limited opportunities for increasing the genetic diversity of a population. In gray, what this does is it decreases the genetic diversity of a population. So very simply, if you look along this axis, the more hatchery fish you release and the lower the effective population size, the worse the effects has on these populations. From a genetics point of view, even in an integrated situation, and especially in a segregated situation, we have to think very carefully about how many fish we're actually putting out into that population because it will compromise the genetic diversity. On top of that, we've actually shown in research, so following a concept developed by Fred Utter in 2004, where essentially he showed these two scenarios where you've got a system with no hatchery releases, lots of population structure. Here you've got a system with lots of hatchery releases, and he predicted that population structure would break down. We did research on this on coho salmon releases in Puget Sound, and essentially found that the more individuals that were exchanged between different drainages, the lower the differentiation between different drainages. So essentially moving all of these fish around is actually causing homogenization. In this graph, what we're showing is that even moving fish around within or releasing large amounts of fish within a river system also reduces genetic structure within a river. We verified this by doing scale analysis as well to support our results. This work has also been recently confirmed in Brook Trout. But most of my discussion today is actually, most of my discussion up until now has been on the effects of the genetic effects of release sizes or the genetic effects on fitness. I wanted to bring your attention to these two publications, the one by Catherine Costa in 2010, where she actually points out that many of the management strategies that are being recommended, whether it's segregated hatcheries or integrated hatcheries, might not mitigate ecological risk factors. Rather, they might exacerbate them. So essentially what she was saying is if we don't pay attention to release sizes, what we're going to do is that we're going to result in a number of undesirable ecological interactions. We've heard a lot about that during this conference. Competition, which might be exacerbated by physical differences between the hatchery and wild fish, density-dependent mortality, residualization in freshwater, carrying capacity, so we've heard that several times, predation. And essentially in this paper, what she does is that she recommends a number of strategies to reduce the ecological effects. Similarly, this paper published by Pearson's in Fisheries in 2010, okay, and essentially what he does is he argues is that the traditional hatchery paradigm is to release approximately the same number of fish over and over again in the same location, okay, regardless of ecological conditions. And he argues that release strategies should consider risks to non-target taxa, carrying capacity, and then a number of ecological feedback mechanisms which can be used as indicators. So essentially what you're seeing in the Pacific Northwest and the Hatchery Scientific Review Group is apparently taking this into account is the actual importance of release sizes and trying to match release sizes to environmental conditions rather than having these static numbers released every single year. So having raised all these issues and raised all these cautions, what I want to do is I want to end with the way that we should be thinking about hatcheries. Essentially, what I really want to advocate is a well-designed system, right, especially if you're considering bringing new hatcheries online that allow research and continual assessments. So the examples that you've seen have been based, the examples that I've given you are based on sound principles, sound research trying to test the principles of hatchery releases. And in thinking about research needs or gaps in this area, I would actually like to bring attention to this publication, which updates the responsible approach to enhancement and releases. And essentially what they advocate is, the authors advocate, is going through these different stages of planning, initial appraisal and goal setting, research and technology development, including pilot studies, before you start the operational implementation of hatcheries. I've discussed a few of the points. If you actually go to the original reference, there's these very clear guidelines about what you should be thinking about. So one of the first things I think that everyone should be paying attention to is what do we know about the wild populations before we start releasing into them. And here we have to think about, in particular, is maintaining the portfolio of populations that you actually have. And really, some of the initial research should be based on population structure, trying to find evidence of local adaptation, right? So evidence for life history variation within and between populations, how much of a portfolio do you actually have in the populations that you're releasing into? Do you know anything about the migration rate between populations? So that gives you the baseline information that tells you whether releasing hatcheries is going to increase stray rates. And very specifically, you actually want to look for changes in structure over time. You might be able to do that retrospectively using scale analyses, genetic techniques. Of course, I'm talking, I'm advocating genetic approaches here because I'm a geneticist. The other thing I'd like to strongly recommend is that we think very, very carefully about the system into which we're releasing these populations. So a system that allows you to conduct research and monitor is actually a very good idea. Now, what's really important about such a system is that really in the ideal world, you actually want these hatchery, these wild systems that are free of hatchery influence, because it's these wild systems that are going to tell you how well the hatchery populations are actually tracking changes over time. A document that allows you a clear framework that allows you to identify trigger points. So you're going to say in your document where you do your feasibility planning, this much genetic change is acceptable, this much ecological impact is acceptable, what are our policies regarding diseases, how much change do we want to the broodstock sources, so what effects do we have on the populations? And if you exceed these trigger points, then it's time to change. So essentially what you have to think about really is a willingness to change or end your practices. And then there's the obvious economic and social analysis. And I'm going to end with a final plug for genetic approaches. Most of the research that I've shown you up until now has allowed long-term tracking of pedigrees, right? So this is the study I was showing you earlier on the segregated hatchery. Essentially, what we've been able to do is that we've been able to track changes from 94 onwards up to 2009, able to track these changes over several generations because it's this generational data that's going to give you the most information. And using the normal traditional marking approaches, I'd strongly advocate for. But if you're able to collect samples both from the hatchery and the wild populations, you can do much longer-term type of data sets. So you can actually determine hatchery ancestry over several generations. You can evaluate those effective population sizes to see if you're getting that Riemann-Laker effect. You can look at rates and impacts of inbreeding. So we've got example publications here. You can actually even use your pedigree data to look at selection differentials in the hatchery compared to the wild. Is there more selection in the hatchery population compared to the wild population? And in a dream world, you can actually estimate the stray rates between the populations. So you can get some sort of idea about the impact of your hatchery releases on the wild populations. So basically what I'd like to advocate is that if you start thinking about hatchery system, think about a very well-designed system that allows very clear research and monitoring that will address the effects of management actions. And so I'd like to thank you.
John Joyce with NOAA. Thank you. Very good presentation. I was wondering, because hatcheries offer control, is there some practices within the hatchery that could be adjusted to minimize, like, the Riemann-Laker effect? Say, like, looking at partial spawning, when you have excess broodstock, using just a portion of the eggs or doing multiple pairings instead of doing one-on-one breedings, would that help to minimize some of those type of concerns?
Yep, that's a great question. It's a very basic genetic theory has actually shown that there are various breeding practices that you can do to maximize the effective population size of your hatchery release, right? So the obvious ones are actually the one-on-one pair matings, right? One aspect that is not actually thought about much in hatcheries is actually equalizing family sizes. That's actually a primary when we did our study on effective population size, it was equalizing family sizes that would have made the biggest difference on improving the effective population size. Yeah.
Hi, thank you. Sam Ramon, Fish and Game. Thank you for that presentation. I really appreciated seeing that laid out like that. I just wanted to say that a lot of what you pointed out in the first two portions about fitness and effective size, or decline of fitness through some of the hatchery practices and effective size of populations, really illustrated the basis for the guidance that our program has in Alaska. I think Alaska's program founders took a lot of that into account. I think they were pretty forward-thinking. And so some of those studies you pointed out really illustrate why one of our cornerstones or keystones of our program is the use of local stocks. We don't do out-of-basin or captive brood, which is what Araki's program and some of the other steelhead things you talked about were doing. So that illustrates why we shouldn't do that. Another the effect of population size, our genetics policy requires us to use a minimum effective population size of 400. And most of our programs greatly exceed that. In the case of our pinks and chum programs, hundreds of thousands of broodstock per year. So I think from that perspective, we're doing pretty well. The third part, when you talked about ecological effects, I think that's where the greatest unknowns are. And I was wondering if you could maybe expand on some of those concerns and maybe try to apply it to our hatchery program in Alaska, which is not like the hatchery programs that you were describing here. So that's something that we would want to watch out for.
So let me start by saying that as a geneticist, my understanding of the ecological interactions is not as good as many of my ecologist colleagues. The biggest, so if you read the Castro paper, she lays out a lot of ideas very clearly. The obvious issues are things like trying to reduce competition between smolts as they out-migrate, for example. So there's smolt release timings. Okay, so that's one issue. Matching the wild fish phenotype to the hatchery fish phenotype, or sorry, vice versa, right? So that you don't have those size differences which are going to advantage the wild population. Sorry, the hatchery population. See, I'm getting myself confused already. The release sites away from the wild populations. But in Todd Pearson's paper, he speaks very, very specifically about using ecological indicators to control the release size. And those in particular, I can't speak to, not being an ecologist, but I, from hearing all the talks I've heard today, I think you already have a lot of those indicators in place. So trying to match the release size to those indicators might be a good idea. Just a comment about the Iraqi paper. They actually used the same stock, the same population. So this was a local broodstock. I totally agree with the use of local broodstocks. And effective population size really should be matched to the wild effective population size, right? So even if you have a large effective population size, it can still cause a depression if the wild population size is larger, right? So something to think about.
Bill Hurd from NOAA Fisheries. First, thank you very much for that presentation. I have a couple of questions. One is, after the detailed hatchery review program in the state of Washington that went on for quite a while, first question is, are there any segregated hatcheries in the state? And on the integrated hatcheries, which I think that's the norm, or at least that's the one of the main outcomes of the hatchery review program, have they been fully implemented, or are they in various stages, or could you say just a bit more about actually what the broad sweep of the programs are?
Right. So there are a number of segregated hatcheries still operating in Washington State. The example I gave you of the test that we performed is very specifically steelhead, right? So in Washington State, the steelhead program in some rivers is based on the segregated strategy where they try and segregate by life history, right? So return timing. To my knowledge, and I will defer at some point, I hope, with the open discussion, to my knowledge, there are no other segregated hatcheries on other populations. I think there is a Chinook. I'm actually looking at Sean Arum. I think there's one Chinook population which is segregated and released in Lower Columbia. My understanding about the integrated hatcheries, and again, I'll may have to defer on this one as well, is that there has been a widespread adoption of this approach throughout the Pacific Northwest. I don't know to what extent. I can't give you percentages, but I think it's pretty close to 100%. Might be exaggerating, but it's high. Yeah.
Bill Hurd again with a follow-up question. You heard John Burke say about the Alaska program and its development over time there were certainly no reticence when hatcheries were not effective for various reasons. They were closed. Alaska's closed a lot of hatcheries. And so my question about the review program in the state of Washington, looking carefully, do you know if any hatcheries, because of that process, have been closed?
I know of hatcheries that have changed to local brood stocks. So, again, I'm looking at Lisa Sieb, who's actually on the Hatchery Scientific Review Group. Perhaps we can ask her that question. I can translate for you.
Maybe not hatchery so much as hatchery program.
Right.
Specific species within a hatchery program. So perhaps keeping the hatchery but closing the coho program.
Right. So Lisa's answer there was many of the programs, not necessarily the hatcheries or the hatchery facilities, but specific programs have been closed down, specifically ones that have used database and ones.
Yeah, I just had a question on one slide there. Towards the end, there was a responsible approach for hatcheries.
Mm-hmm.
And stage one, the first stage one objective was, one was identifying the goals.
Yeah.
And that was then identifying the release objectives, which kind of took me by surprise. I thought some of the whole premise of the hatchery review down there was getting hatchery people to realize their objective wasn't to release a certain number of fish, it was to produce a certain number of adults. And John Burke spoke to that. So I don't know if that was the release objective based on a number of adult objective goal, or is that...
No, I'm sorry, that one's not so clear, but essentially the major emphasis on that was actually to trying to decide what is the hatchery trying to do. Is it a fishery enhancement hatchery? Is it a conservation-based hatchery? And then after that, what should your release objectives be within that framework, right?
Well, that concludes our presentations for session four. I hope you've been filling out those cards. Thanks to the presenters. Those were some excellent presentations, I thought. We're going to take a break right now for about 15 minutes. Please get those cards to people who are standing. Raise your hand. They'll come collect them, and we'll get started in about 15 or 20 minutes on our public portion. Thanks.